Stay tuned for The Lin Show. Today, I'm playing an interview with my very first dramaturg. This is Lauren Sasso, who is the dramaturg at the Oslo Repertory Theatre Company. And as Lauren tells it, she has responsibilities that few other dramaturgs have. Lauren's is an interesting story. Listen to the way she wandered around trying to decide what it was in theater that she wanted to do and how it felt when she discovered dramaturgy. Hang on. Here come the show.
Hearing from an inner voice, finding choice where there's no choice, with gentle prodding from the voice. Oh, you really can. Deeper, deeper down you dive, where the child's gone to survive. From nowhere, sitting in my own soft lap, with all the time for us to chat, and my resources all on tap. Oh,
hello, and welcome to The Lin Show. The Lin Show is about being the person that you really are. I know it seems odd that we can be someone we're not, but in fact, as a therapist, it is clear to me that most of us are presenting to the world people that we are, but not the whole person that we are. Presenting to the world parts of ourselves, but not our complete self. And it is also clear to me that the more of you are able to accept and demonstrate, the easier your life will be. So, in my show, I interview people who make their living or their life with an art. Because when you listen to a person who makes their living or their life with an art, you can hear what it sounds like to be who you really are. Today's interview with Lauren Sasso is an example of someone who thought she was something, tried to be that thing, and then, when she realized what she really was, and in actual fact, Lauren Sasso has always been a dramaturg, you can hear her say, it was like a door opening up inside her, welcoming her into the world that was always supposed to be hers. It's a lovely story. So, without further ado, here is dramaturg Lauren Sasso. So I'm here with Lauren Sasso, who is the dramaturg at the Oslo Repertory Theatre, We're in the little conference room. And I'm explaining to Lauren that I interview people who make their living or their life within art. Mm-hmm. And it's clear that the art to which you are giving your life and currently making your living is the art of theater, mm-hmm. would you say?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, good. So I want to ask you to talk about what a dramaturg is, mm-hmm. what they do, what you do. But I actually have one question,
okay.
which is the one I ask.
Sure.
So it is, do you remember, and can you tell me, the very first moment in your life when you were drawn to, thought about, were enamored of, discovered theater, stories, any of that?
Yes, I do.
Good.
And it's a combination of my own very hazy childhood memories and, you know, my parents telling me the stories again and again. When I was three, I had two very distinct and polar opposite reactions to pieces of art that I was taken to by my parents. We went to go see Peter Pan.
The play?
And, yes, mm-hmm. yes. And I loved it so much and was so excited in the car on the way home that I was bouncing up and down in my seat. I was so enamored of the whole thing. And I was bouncing up and down so much that I made myself ill. I was so, you know. And on the complete opposite end of the spectrum, later that same year, they took me to see The Nutcracker. And I did not like that at all.
The ballet.
Mm-hmm. And they tell me that I kept throwing my skirt up over my head. And in the car on the way home, I kept saying, it was horrible. It was horrid. H-O-R-R-I-D, horrid. Saying it and spelling it.
And At three.
And so later in life, I've often looked back on that and kind of jokingly said, well, I was destined to be a dramaturg or a critic from the start because I was having very intense reactions to things very early on.
I'm just curious. Do you remember either one of those experiences?
I don't remember The Nutcracker at all. I remember little bits of seeing Peter Pan, but I don't remember the aftermath.
No, you don't remember the jumping up and down.
Right. But I remember little bits of seeing Peter fly and little bits of the play. I think that also, you know, my dad, who has been an arts journalist in Rhode Island for my entire life, and when I was growing up, would always take me with him to the openings at Trinity Rep, and we always went to a Christmas carol as a family when I was young, and so I have all of these memories also of seeing that show year after year after year, and the way that the theater is, or at least was at the time, set up there, you often had to walk through part of the backstage or the wing areas to get to your seats. And so I'd have the experience of seeing some of the props laid out or some of the things that they were preparing for the costumes, and it really made a very visceral visual impact on me. I was very curious about that. And so I was very interested in theater for a very long time.
Yeah, it compelled you right from the beginning.
Yeah.
I mean, it is interesting. The Peter Pan, you know, you're not the only person mm-hmm. whose theater career began with Peter Pan. I mean, I think Mary Martin has a lot,
yes,
you know, to answer for in that way.
Absolutely.
But not a lot of kids, it seemed to me, would be interested in, compelled by the backstage stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Then, you know, most of them would have just walked right by it and, you know, heading for the more dramatic.
Well, I remember when I was about 6 or 7, one of those Christmas Carol experiences, they had a big prop body for Jacob Marley that was laid out, and you kind of can't help but look at this prop corpse,
yes.
and be fascinated and a little bit horrified, and you wonder, what is that thing? and it was so, all of that stuff was so there right in front of you. And Trinity was always so great about direct engagement with the audience. The way that their theater physical space was set up, you often were in the round or almost completely in the round, and the actors did a lot of very, not direct address, but they would go out into the audience. Scenes would be staged on little platforms in the middle of the audience area. You felt from the beginning like you were really in the show. And growing up going to that, it made it very easy to get wrapped up in theater magic. And I did, like many people who wind up in the arts, think at first that I was going to be an actor. That was, you know, from about the time I was a very little child until I was in college.
Okay, hold on. So, very little child,
four.
Because already you knew what actor was. You knew that it was something that it did that, right?
Yes.
Right. Okay.
I mean, and the original impulse was very hazy. It was very abstract. It was just like, I want to act.
Yeah. I want to be a part of that.
Yeah.
Right.
And as I get, you know, to be a teenager, it refined into, I actually really want to do that.
Yeah, well, hold on. I want to hear the whole thing. So, did you say to your family at that time, did they know that you were enamored of acting
mm-hmm.
at 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, right?
Yes. There was a brief pause from about 9 to 13 where I thought, no, you can't make a sustainable living doing that. I should do something sensible. And I thought, well, maybe I'll be an interior designer because I still wanted to do something creative.
Yes.
But
yes.
I thought there might be more money in that or sustainability.
It'd be safer.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. And then when I was 13, I kind of said, no, theater's really what I want to do.
Well, were there plays in school? Were you in plays?
When I get to junior high, I obviously...
Okay, but not in elementary school. They didn't have a drama club. They didn't
have none
of that. Okay.
Yeah.
But you continue to go.
Mm-hmm.
You continue to get a backlog of, right? Of,
yeah.
Okay. So junior high,
mm-hmm.
they have a drama club? They have plays?
The music department actually put on a musical once a year in junior high and in high school. And as soon as I could start doing those, I started auditioning for them. And, you know, it's the sort of thing where they fill out the chorus with almost everybody, but you get to be on stage.
Did you sing? Do you sing?
I do, yeah.
So did you study?
For a while in high school, I had a voice teacher for a couple of years, and I enjoyed it. But mostly, it's just been either school choir or choir with my church, which I still do. That kind of somewhat instructed, but not extremely rigorous.
Okay, so you didn't have piano lessons or theory?
I did, actually. I played the piano as well. I was never the best piano student. I was a better voice student than I was a piano student. I didn't like to practice the piano, and I'm sure I drove my teacher crazy. She was a very patient woman. And I took lessons for about 11 years, and I would say I was adequate. I didn't retain much of it. I could still, if you put sheet music in front of me and I spent a lot of time with it, I could get to the point where I could play it. But I can't really just sit down and
okay, so can you read for a choral piece? Can you read it off the page, or you just learn it because you hear it? And
it's a little bit of both.
Right. I've when you go up and down.
Yeah, I've been doing it long enough now that I can sight read, but it always helps me to be in the choral situation to listen to somebody else as well. It's a combination of things for me. I wouldn't say that. I'm the most skilled sight reader, but I do okay.
You're all right. Okay. Okay. So you get cast in the musicals in chorus,
mm-hmm.
but you don't get cast in parts?
No. And that was fine. It was just a chance to be more involved in theater. And I started doing some things with community theater around about that time as well.
What?
More musicals, more plays.
So you're performing. You're on stage,
mm-hmm.
right?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, and you obviously like it because you keep doing it,
yeah.
right? Right.
Yeah.
And so through all of this time, except for 9 to 13,
yeah.
right? And that's an interesting time.
Mm.
I mean, again, most kids are probably not thinking mm-hmm. at that period of time in their life that you know this is a safe, you know, lucrative way, but you did, and then...
Well, and again, I think the way that when I decided that I wanted to act when I was 4 was just kind of like a big idea.
Mm-hmm.
Even at 9, the idea of, oh, I want to be an interior designer was just sort of a vague concept because it sounded like something stable.
Yeah.
But when I came back to the idea of, no, it's got to be theater at 13, that was a much more real idea to me. I had felt like I had thought about it a lot, and I still, you know, looking back now, there was so much I didn't know at 13, but I felt like it was understanding that it could often be a financially unstable life, and you know, kind of nomadic life. I still thought it's the place where I can absolutely love what I'm doing every day. It's the place where work won't feel like work. And that's the kind of job that I want to have. And I never really looked back from that ever again, even when my focus later shifted from being on stage to being a dramaturg.
So did you ever discuss this with your family?
Oh, all the time.
Yes, and yeah. They said, fine.
Yes. yeah, I mean, they always wanted me to do what made me happy. They obviously were concerned about how I'd support myself, and they were nothing but supportive. And the one kind of, I wouldn't say it's a condition that they placed on it, but the one thing they always urged me to do was to get a liberal arts education as my undergrad, rather than following a conservatory-style acting training, because they wanted me to have a broader experience and to be able to invest in more parts of the world and my life. Should this not pan out, they wanted me to have more options.
Yeah.
So, and I don't regret that at all. So.
Okay, so it's high school, mm-hmm. and you're in musicals,
yeah.
and you know that you want to be in theater, mm-hmm. and you decide that you're going to major in liberal arts.
Well, yes. My high school experience, we also did one big show a year. We did a full-scale, fully costumed, staged Gilbert and Sullivan operetta every year, which was a very interesting experience because we weren't doing Broadway musicals. The music director at my high school was a wonderfully talented man, and he firmly believed that having that classical foundation meant you could sing anything later. So sometimes a few kids would complain a little bit and say, why can't we do the stuff that's, you know,
yeah.
more popular now? But everybody really grew to love it, and they were kind of these huge landmark events in the town, and the whole, you know, we'd do three performances and they would sell out.
Yeah.
And they were tremendous fun. And I did a lot of community theater at that time, and then I went to college with the idea that I was going to major in theater and minor in English, but get that full, you know, liberal arts, humanities experience.
So is that what you did?
That is what I did.
Where did you go to school?
My first year I did at Mount Holyoke,
mm-hmm.
and it wasn't the right fit after that first year, and so I transferred.
Do you remember why?
Yes, I loved many things about the school. It's a terrific school in a beautiful place, but the theater department was very small, and there weren't a ton of opportunities to do stuff very actively until you were a junior or senior.
Oy.
yeah, and at least at that time, there weren't. I'm not quite sure what it's like now. And they're part of the Five College Consortium in the Pioneer Valley, and you could do things at the other schools in that consortium, but if you didn't have a car, being on that bus system was very
mm-hmm.
hard, and it just made it kind of restrictive in terms of doing what I really hoped to do. And so I wanted to be in a place where there were more opportunities for that. So after my first year, I transferred to Wellesley, and I finished out there. And similarly, small theater program, but it was much more active, and you could be much more involved right away, and there was more activity in the student organizations. You could do the department shows or student shows. I was also a member of the Shakespeare Society there, which did two shows a year. And so there were about 14 different production opportunities that anybody could get involved with, no matter what your class year was. So, and it was much closer to Boston, so you had just a lot more activity in the neighborhood of the campus. So it was a much better fit.
Yeah, it sounds like it
yeah.
worked really well for you.
Yeah.
Okay, so were you majoring in theater, minoring in English. So were you having acting? Were you having mm-hmm. makeup? Were you having directing? Were you having
A little bit of a lot of that.
Yeah.
With the Shakespeare Society, I get the opportunity to be on stage pretty much every semester. And it was a small student-run organization, so you were on stage and you were doing things off stage. You get assigned to the costume team or the makeup team or something else to build the sets. And within the theater department, you had to obviously take requirements that were not just about acting. So I spent a semester or two in tech class and learning a lot of the behind the scenes. I wasn't very good at anything that required power tools, but I muddled my way through that semester. And, you know, I started to take classes in dramaturgy at that point.
Hold on, I was just going to get there. The question I was going to ask is, at what point did you discover dramaturgy, that it was something?
Yeah.
And when did that begin to look interesting to you, and how did you pursue it?
Right. That was a longer evolution. The class that I took as an undergrad was sort of the first point where I...
They had a class in...
They did. It was my senior year, I believe, so it was pretty late.
Oh, really?
In the process. It was a small department, and so the electives rotated through, and...
And so it was an elective, which you chose.
Yes, and the department, you had to independently design your theater major because of the size of the department. So really everybody who was a theater major coming out of Wellesley put it together in their own way. And so it was a choice to take that class.
Did you know what it was before you took it?
Not really. And that class was the first class where I really get to learn about what it was.
And do you remember why you chose it? I mean, did it fit your schedule or something?
No, it was the interest in learning more about what it was, because I started to understand that it was about history and research and theory as well as practical creative application.
Yeah, so this is interesting because so far you haven't mentioned this stuff as compelling to you. I mean, understand?
There was a big shift. There was a big shift for me, and it didn't even really start with that class. It was interesting to me. I took it because I wanted to know more about it, and that was the first place I really encountered what dramaturgy was. But I would say I still thought that when I left college that I was going to be an actor.
Yeah.
And for the next 3 years after I was out of undergrad, I was applying for acting master's programs.
Oh, wow.
And I was auditioning for those, and not successfully. And I was working survival jobs and trying to figure out how I was going to be an actor.
Yeah, this is really interesting to me. So all this time, you have not said, this is what I am, this is what I do.
Right. It was an evolution.
Clearly.
At that point.
Yeah. So the other thing that I alluded to and I want to go back to a little bit is the idea of research, the idea of history, the idea of the backstory.
Yeah.
You haven't mentioned it, as I said, as a, you know, you said, you know, you really love being on stage, you really love singing, and you know, you like to, but you didn't mention not only an interest, but a comfort with a desire to do.
Yeah.
Did you know that you had this all along?
I think so. I've always been a reader. I've always been very much into, well, and that was the part of me that was the English lit minor, you know, that loved comparative lit, that loved picking apart a text, and I think that's why, you know, because I was always interested in being the performer, but I was always interested in understanding what I was performing. And so I think that was what drove me towards, you know, keeping English lit in the mix. And I have always loved to really understand, even when I thought I was going to be a performer, really understand what I was saying, but the whole scope of the story. And, you know, I've been a voracious reader all my life. You know, when I was a kid, I wouldn't go anywhere without 3 books, at least. I would read at the dinner table, I would read in the car, I would read anywhere that you could take me, I would have a book on my person somewhere. And
yeah.
That's still kind of true.
Yeah, and it's interesting because I didn't ask, but was curious why English. As because there were a lot of options.
Yeah.
Okay, so you take this class as an undergraduate. sort of because you think it might be interesting because, right, okay, good. So it's kind of in the back of your mind now, right? And you're auditioning. So what happens?
So I was working survival jobs for a while I was doing these auditions. I worked at Target for a little while. I worked on a college campus for a little bit, you know, try to save some money. And so around about the second year of this continual auditioning process, I had applied to go to Shakespeare and Company. I had done a month-long intensive with them in the summer of 2001. So then 2002, I had applied for their full summer performance institute, and I got waitlisted. And so I thought, that's another sign that, you know, this isn't going to happen. And I had started to, I think that had started to shift something, and I started to think, well, maybe this isn't going to happen for me. Maybe being on stage isn't going to happen for me. And I can't remember. It's long enough ago now that I can't remember if it was at that point. I think it was where I had applied for one of these programs, one of the MFA programs in acting for the third time, and had gotten rejected again. And I had applied to multiple different programs over the 3 years that I was trying to do that, but there was only one program that I had applied to three times, and it was this one. And I had gotten to know the program heads fairly well over the 3 years, and one of them kind of pulled me aside. I happened to be at a party where they were also at, and they pulled me aside and personally, you know, told me that they weren't going to be accepting my application, but in that same conversation said, have you ever thought about dramaturgy? They said your application essays have always been so well written. You clearly have an interest in theater beyond performance, and it might be something you should consider. So then I started thinking back to that class I'd taken as an undergrad, and I thought, well, I know what this is, but I've never really seriously considered it. And so then I got waitlisted at Shakespeare and Company, and I thought, well, maybe this is all a sign.
Yeah, let's stop for a second. I really want to, I like to highlight this. Mm-hmm. I don't know how many stories I've heard like this where somebody says, you know, have you thought of, or you seem to be good at, or, you know, that, and it turns a person's life entirely around.
Yeah.
I don't know. We don't think of it as particularly the way people decide things or the way it happens, but clearly it does.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
And so this becomes a kind of tipping point for you, right?
Yeah.
Okay.
And so then I get a word that somebody else has dropped out of the Shakespeare and Company program, and I've gotten accepted off the wait list. And I almost didn't go because I had just started this process of trying to accept I'm not going to be an actor. And then the universe is telling me, oh, wait, you can still have one more acting experience.
Long ago, I developed a theory that the minute you say, all right, fine, I'm not going to have that, it isn't mine, the universe says, are you sure?
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
Yeah, so.
But I it was a lot of soul searching to decide if I was going to go. And my parents encouraged me. They said, if you know, because it was also, you know, you had to pay to go. It was a financial decision as well. And they said, if everything else were equal, do you want to do it? And I said yes. So they encouraged me to go, and that's what I mean. They've always been very, very supportive about everything. And so I went, and I spent 3 months in Lenox working on the Henry VI plays and understudying on their main stage and taking classes with their company members. And it was a fantastic time. But all the while, I was also wrestling with, am I going to keep doing this? And you know, they had a lot of mentorship meetings with the company members there, and you could talk to them about where you were at. And I remember one of them saying to me, why do you have to be one thing? Why do you have to be one thing? And he pointed out that he acted, he wrote plays, he worked in their administration. You know, what's the harm in kind of exploring this for a bit? And he said, you might come back to acting, you might never come back to acting. And it's turned out for me to be the latter. But he said, what's the harm in at least opening the door to that?
So had you mentioned your interest, or he...
Yeah, it was in these kind of ongoing
right sessions.
Yeah, and so that got me thinking about it even more and saying, well, what's the harm in exploring it? And so then a bunch of things happened very quickly after that. I was at that program from mid-May to about just before Labor Day. And I had applied for a job because I was too late to really start applying for dramaturgy graduate programs for that year. So I knew I would need to work for one more year before I could try to go to grad school for that.
There's a graduate program in dramaturgy?
Several, yes. Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. But I knew I needed, because I was shifting gears, I needed to do research on what those programs were. I needed to figure out where I wanted to apply. And I had sort of missed the cycle for the current academic year. So I knew I needed to work for another year. And my mom had, by chance, had somebody from a theater, a very small theater that unfortunately does not exist anymore. It was in Providence, called Perishable Theater.
It perished.
It did eventually. Well, and you know, it's really, it makes me sad even now. They had gotten well past the 20-year mark when they had to fold. And they were completely dedicated to new work. It was all about developing playwrights and developing new work. And it was a terrific space. And it just, it didn't end up sustaining. Their long-term artistic director left, and it didn't last too long after that, a few more years. Where was I? So she'd had a chance encounter with somebody who was on their staff. They had come in to try to book an event. She worked at the time at Rhode Island College, and she was at that time their director of conferences and special events, and so anybody who wanted to book space had to book through her. So the woman from Perishable came in and was trying to book something for an event with my mom and mentioned that they were looking for an office manager. And so my mom let me know, and I applied while I was still at Shakespeare and Company. And sight unseen, they did a phone interview, and they hired me. And so I finished at Shakespeare and Company the day before Labor Day, moved home, started this job the day after Labor Day. And it was terrific. It was, you know, a chance to work on the staff of a theater and have that be my quote-unquote survival job. And that was the first time where my survival job wasn't something like a retail job.
It was part of what you do.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah. Exactly. And so I get to learn a lot about, you know,
how it works.
Administration, even on a very small scale. You know, what it was like to sit in a staff meeting for a theater, what it was like to run all of the office systems for a theater. So I did that for a year while I was researching and applying for graduate programs in dramaturgy. And that was a much happier application experience. I got accepted to several of the programs I applied to and waitlisted a few. But it was instantly, when I started really digging into what it was and looking at what it could be, I've used this metaphor often when I've talked to people about it, that it felt to me like a door opened somewhere in my brain, and it opened up this whole other room in my mind, and I thought, this is where I should have been all along. And it took me a long time to get to there, but it felt like coming home.
Well, how old were you?
Oh, let's see, that would have been 2002, 24.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And again, I want to make two points here. One of them is something that you have alluded to several times, and I would have stopped you earlier to say, the significance, the importance, the essential nature of support from family.
Mm-hmm.
It is what makes the difference,
yeah.
You know, and I always want to highlight it. I always want to say, see, this is what happens if you do it right,
yeah.
You know.
They've always believed in me, sometimes more than I believe in myself, you know, and been able to push me along when I've struggled and, you know, really talk through things with me as well. That's, like, one of the things I've always appreciated most about the relationship that I have with my parents, is that we can talk about anything, and we can really talk about it. So,
well, and what I hear you saying is that you're not going to get the toe the line kind of thing from them. Mm. They really are going to hear you.
They want me to make smart decisions, but they trust me to make smart
decisions.
And that is
the essential nature of support.
Yeah.
Is trust.
Yeah. Mm,
right? And and you said earlier, you know, that they wanted you to be happy.
Mm-hmm.
You know, parents who want their kids to be happy, support them.
Yeah.
You know, right.
Absolutely.
Okay, so I wanted to say that. And, oh, this other thing about the door opening.
Yeah.
You hear this a lot, too, in interviews with people who have found a place,
mm-hmm.
right? A lot of times I hear it with people saying, I was an outcast, I was an outlier, I was a nerd, I didn't fit anywhere, and then I went to the drama club.
Yeah.
And I knew, right? It's that thing.
Mm-hmm.
So the point I always try and make is that it is possible to know
mm-hmm.
who you are
mm-hmm.
and what is right for you.
Absolutely.
Right?
And so
if you don't have that, it doesn't mm-hmm. mean that you can't have it.
Exactly.
Right.
Exactly.
Great. So the door opens as you are doing the research
mm-hmm.
here,
mm-hmm.
and it says hello.
I think it was cracking open from the moment that I got accepted off the wait list to the Shakespeare and Company program, and that whole summer it kept swinging a little bit further, and then when I fully decided to commit to it and really dig into that research on the graduate programs for the field, that's when it kind of really flung open. I was like, this is what I should have been doing.
Yeah.
So I fairly easily decided that I wanted to go to UMass Amherst for their dramaturgy program because there were a lot of factors. Partly it was because it was well-established, partly because it was a small program, and I thought that there would be a lot of individual attention from the professors, and partly because in doing the research, it was very quickly evident that they believed in a hands-on approach. They would put you right into working on productions in their department, where a lot of the other programs that I was looking at were more about observing for a long time. And I think as I'm hearing myself talk about these things, that hands-on thing is something that is a recurring pattern
yeah.
with me. So I went out for an in-person interview, and when they offered me the spot, it was a fairly easy decision to say yes to them. And so that meant I was back to the Pioneer Valley, where I'd started with Mount Holyoke about 10 years before, 8 years before. And so it was familiar, but not. And I really enjoyed my time at UMass a lot.
Okay, so do you want to talk a little bit about, or as much as you like, about what it means? What does a drama
I get this question a lot.
I'm sure you do.
From a lot of patrons here, from people who aren't in theater. And my very quick answer is, that's a long answer. because it is different for just about everybody who does it.
Really?
I am very lucky in this position to be attached to a regional theater, to be an institutional dramaturg. And I have a variety of tasks that touch almost every different department in the theater. But other regional theaters who have dramaturgs on their staff don't necessarily use them exactly the same way. They might split out some of those duties into a separate literary manager, or they might have the dramaturg work solely in the production process and have somebody else handle new play development. I sort of do a little bit of everything here. So it's kind of easier to say what I do than
yes, by all means, what you do is right.
So sometimes it means hosting a panel discussion, as I did earlier this week for Guys and Dolls.
Yes, and I want to say I was really interested. I've seen you mm-hmm. Host them before, and I was really interested in how much you knew mm-hmm. about Damon Runyon, about about all of the pieces that go into making this mm-hmm. right.
Well, that's part of where the research part of
yeah,
the
yeah.
dramaturg kicks in, and those panels are kind of a perfect melding of the research aspect of it and the more community engagement aspect of it. But sometimes it's hosting a panel discussion like that. Sometimes it is spending a lot of time doing research to create an actor packet that the director and actors might use as a resource about the historical period or the political issues of a show in the rehearsal process. And a lot of that same research that fuels the packets and makes me able to talk about things with people at the panels also goes into writing articles for our playbills. So all of that kind of that research serves a lot of needs. And also a lot of times I will be, let me back up actually. One of the other things that I like to say about what a dramaturg is when I'm not talking about what I specifically do is that it's a bridge builder and it's a great sort of contextualizer. I like to say the shepherd of the cultural conversation. I borrowed that from somebody and I can't even remember who I borrowed it from now, but that idea that you are the liaison between the art and how people absorb it, that you create a greater context around it so that, you know, somebody in the audience might come and see the show, enjoy the show, but also get to read these interesting articles or go and listen to a panel like that. I also sort of serve that function within the staff because I work very closely with Michael on season selection, you know, and he has a very distinct artistic vision for where this theater is going, and he is so busy that sometimes
he can't relate that
to everybody on the staff at the same time. So I'll work with the marketing department to make sure that the blurbs that they're putting in the ticket brochures really make sense for what the plays mean.
And what it means to the whole concept.
Yes. I'll work with the development department on making sure that the artistic portions of grant narratives are actually, you know, aligning with what we're trying to do. And just sort of continually, if people are doing an event or doing something about the plays, they'll usually say, well, what can you tell me about this aspect of it? Or, I mean, even something for, like, the Starry Night dinners, sometimes being asked to give input on what
kind of food they should have.
No. I leave that totally to the special events department.
Okay, good.
There's one where they do a big dinner on stage at the end of the season, and they try to do trivia questions that are based on a lot of the plays. So a lot of the time my office will get asked to help consult on what would be good trivia questions based on the content that we've put on stage this season. So pretty much, I pretty much work with every department except the tech staff in a really direct way.
So for every play?
Mm-hmm.
So do you have to start doing this before the season?
Well, God. Well before.
Yeah, because there's no time otherwise, right?
And the other part of my job is that I'm also the casting associate. And so That's a whole other, and that's not usual. In my experience, I've only found one other dramaturg who also is listed as being involved in casting on the staff website.
So does it mean you go to New York?
No, but I work with our New York casting director and our Chicago casting director. I provide them all of the scripts, the side materials that the directors have picked. That's a whole other part of my job. I would say that right now, my year is divided into sections, and right now we are very much in the middle to back end of the season selection part of things. So while on stage we're getting ready for Guys and Dolls and living in that moment, my brain is also on what we're planning for 17-18, 18-19 a little bit. And so I'm kind of living in 2 years simultaneously.
Well, actually, I mean, as you describe it, I'm thinking if you don't do that, there's not enough time to do all the stuff you have to do.
Exactly.
I mean, I'm glad you like to read all the time because I'm sure that's a lot of what you're doing.
Yes. I would say in the past 2 months I've read close to 40 plays. And my apprentice has read close to 40 plays, and they're not all the same 40. So, So, and Michael has been reading even more things than that, and Greg has, and it's always this conversation that is going on. We read so much more than ever hits the stage. We have to figure out, you know, are they appealing to our audience? Do they work well with each other? Can we cast them?
Do they fit into the concept?
Do they fit? Yeah, there are so many reasons why something that we really love may not end up working, or something that we weren't considering at first suddenly becomes a really great candidate. But so I'm sort of in the mid to tail end of really heavy reading for next year and the year beyond season selection. When we get past that, it verges much more into being a production dramaturg and being in the rehearsal room and answering questions. You know, we're going to be doing The Great Society to kick off the rep part of our season.
Right.
Huge play, huge historical amount of information, real people who are being represented as fictional characters.
Are you benefiting at all from the play that you did last year?
Tremendously.
It's the same period and all, right?
Well, and it's exact continuation of
yeah.
the story.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
It will pick up from the moment that the curtain went down on all the way. That is where The Great Society opens.
Right.
We'll go right back to that
right.
moment.
So that helped you a lot.
Yes.
Right?
Yeah, it did lay a lot of the groundwork, but there are several characters who we don't see, who were in All the Way, who don't continue.
They don't
on,
show up, right.
And there are a whole host of new people who do. This play covers 4 years, where All the Way covered one, and it really focuses not just on LBJ's presidency, but on the civil rights movement a lot more heavily, what was going on in Vietnam. It is hugely more expansive in scope. So we had it was great that we had
yeah.
some of the building materials
right.
already. So I'll be in the room a lot more, and that's where I sort of am a resource. We try to make those packets to answer a lot of questions right up front for the actors, and there's invariably something we miss, or an actor will come at something, or the director will want something that we didn't even think of.
Right.
So we go to rehearsals to try to, you know, say, take a list down of stuff, and this is where technology has been a great thing, because it used to be you have to take that list away and go and do that research and come back with it.
Now you can do it on your phone.
Well, yeah, I bring my tablet to
right.
every rehearsal, and
mm-hmm.
like, I will have an answer for you by the next break, or
yeah.
at least some resources that we can continue to look at. And then when we do season announcement in mid-March, that's when I sort of flip over and really put my casting hat on, because as soon as we have gone public with what we're doing for the next year, we start thinking about how we're going to cast it.
Right. And theoretically, you will have had to have done
mm-hmm.
all of that other research stuff. Then,
yeah,
right.
Yeah, I mean these are not hard sections.
No,
of my
clearly
years.
Not.
Bleed over.
Right,
the boundaries.
Clearly not. But there's emphasis.
Yes.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
And my focus shifts from
right,
one
right,
to the
right,
other.
Right,
to
right,
the
right,
other.
Right, right.
And so from mid March to about mid June, early July is really casting. And I will, as I mentioned before, I will liaise with our casting directors in New York and Chicago, and that is a lot of talking to the directors about what do they want to use for the sides, making sure that they've had a chance to sign off on all that material, getting the scripts and those sides to the casting directors, getting character descriptions to the casting
right.
directors, and then coordinating the dates of the auditions, making sure that Michael can go to all of them,
right.
making sure that the directors can go if possible. Making sure all of that happens. And then
This is a lot of the administrative stuff that you had,
mm-hmm.
that you got at, right?
Yeah.
At Perishable.
Yeah.
Right?
Yes. Yeah.
Yeah.
And then locally, I run all of our local auditions. We do a giant open audition, usually in late April, early May. And I will actually watch all of those. We usually get a little bit over 100 people. 100 to 125 people is pretty good.
Locally?
Yeah. Yes. depends on what we're doing,
mm-hmm.
how many people we're looking for.
Right.
And so I sit and audit all of those auditions. And then in mid-May, I'm our representative to the Florida Professional Theater Association. So they have a statewide audition every year, usually held in Vero Beach, although this year it's going to be in Sarasota. FST is hosting it. And that gets about 300-plus actors, some of the same people that all have already seen at
mm-hmm.
ours, but often quite a few new faces. And I will go for 2 days and sit through those auditions. And I take the list of the people I saw locally, the list of the people I saw at FICTA auditions, and sort of you know, pick out the people that we want to call back. And then Michael and the director for, usually those are most useful for musicals. And so Michael and the director of the musical in June will come down and do a local callback that has worked in concert with the New York auditions for that musical. This summer it was a little hard to get those all together because Michael was away traveling for quite a while and Josh Rhodes was working on a project on the West Coast. And it was just hard to get all of them in the same room at the same time. So the casting process went on a little bit longer for this show than it normally would. But, you know, I will be the first pass on a lot of the local auditions, and then they come in.
Wow, that's amazing. That's a lot of responsibility. I mean, my God, it's a humongous amount of responsibility.
But there's a lot.
Well, I'm glad you have an apprentice.
Yes, but there's a lot of you know, I feel a lot of pride in it too, because I feel like there are certain people who I know I saw and brought to Michael's attention or to the director's attention, and if they get cast, it feels really good.
Of course it does. Of course it does. You can have pride about all of this. I mean, my God, this is a 24/7, you know, 12-month job.
Yes.
You know, right. Yeah. Right.
Vacation time is hard to come by.
Sure,
very much welcome to the cast.
Okay, we're going to have to stop soon for you.
Yeah.
And I have just one quick question, and it is, you know, having done this job now for quite a while.
This is my 11th season.
Yeah, that's a lot. Would you just say as succinctly as you can, what that's like, what that feels like, what that means to you?
Oh, my gosh. You know, when I went through grad school, I felt my mind and my worldview expanding and my heart expanding every year that I was there. And it was a 3-year program, and I learned so much. And I think that when I came here, I'd never lived outside of New England before. I'd never, you know, even considered moving to Florida till this job came on the radar. And I didn't know what it was going to be. I didn't know anything about the town. I didn't know anything about the state. And I felt like I learned, it's been like, you know, another grad school in a way. And I keep feeling my mind and my heart and my worldview expanding with everything that we do here. And I think that's the ideal goal of theater, right? Is to broaden your horizons and to make you be a more open-minded and understanding person and, you know, a better citizen of the world. And I certainly think that job has done that for me. And, you know, my family is still back in New England, and it's been incredibly hard to be so far away from them for so long. But I do feel like I, cliched as it might sound, have found another family here. You know, Michael talks a lot about making this an artistic home for the artists that we work with. But it's just as much of an artistic home for the staff. And, you know, everybody here does more than their job description. Collaboration and working across the boundaries of different departments is huge, huge to us. And we couldn't really work if we didn't all give it our all. And that sense of collaboration and willingness to go the extra mile and really truly having each other's backs.
Yeah, it's commitment to the whole.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah, it has made it a very special place to work.
Yeah, it's great.
It's great. Plus, you know, I love every show that we've done. You know? it's just fantastic to, you know, after all that hard work, to go down to the theater and just enjoy what's on stage. And Guys and Dolls is going to be amazing. The little bits of it that I've seen in tech and in the rehearsal room, I think it's going to knock everybody's socks off. It's beautiful and fun, and it's just going to be such a gorgeous production. So, so well done.
It's a great place to stop. Thank you so much, Lauren Sasso.
I'm happy to have done it.
I hope that by listening to Lauren and hearing the way she continued to pursue what seemed to her to be her road, her life, her passion, until she found it, that you are asking yourself, have I done that? Have I continued to pursue what it seems to me is the road for me? Well, if that hasn't happened for you, if you haven't done that, if you feel that you are somehow cheating yourself from who you really are and what you are really supposed to be doing, and you want to talk to me about that, you can find me at my website, thelinshow.com. Just click on the email tab, ask me any question you like. I'll be happy to answer them. And as you heard Lauren say, Guys and Dolls is terrific. It's spectacular. It's everything she said and more. It's only playing for a little while longer. But if you can get a ticket, do not hesitate. Get a ticket and run down to see Guys and Dolls. Also, The Great Society, which is coming up and which I am certain is going to be terrific. So, as always, I hope that you heard something in this show that you can use. Something that you didn't know. Perhaps you didn't know what a dramaturg was, as you could hear. I didn't. Something that you knew but had forgotten. Something that's going to make you come down and see Guys and Dolls and The Great Society. Something that will bring you back. Because I will be back next week, same time, same station. And as always, I sure hope you will be, too.
You see, I'm getting older. My hair is turning gray. Oh, you say my face and figure have both seen better days. Well, I won't be retiring. I won't slip out of sight. No, I will not go gentle into that good night. I won't go with a whimper. I am going with a bang. Life's a song I keep on singing, not a tune that I once sang. I just keep returning like some goddamn boomerang. No, I won't go with a whimper. I am going with a bang. You see that I have had my shot. My time has come and gone. Oh, won't I please get off the stage, let someone else get on. Well, I won't be relegated or leave without a fight. No, I will not go gentle into that good night. I won't go with a whimper. I am going with a bang. Life's a bell I keep on ringing, not a chime that I once rang. You may think it's unseemly. Well, I don't give a dang. No, I won't go with a whimper. I am going with a bang. Rising from the ashes every chance I get. I may be running out of time, but it ain't over yet. 'Cause me and Sister Phoenix, we won't give up the flight. No, no, we will not go gentle into that good night. And I won't go with a whimper. I'm going with a bang. Life's a song I keep on singing, not a tune that I once sang. I may not be as juicy, hell, but I still got some tang. So you won't hear me simper. I may have gotten limper, but I won't go with the wind.